Welcome to A Million Other Choices. I am, as always, your host, Kim. Here is where we discuss the dark truth of true crime. You can reach me by email at amillionotherchoices@outlook.com. As an independent channel and podcast, I rely on program-generated ads to recover expenses. You can join me ad-free and without these silly introductions, and as well for bonus episodes on Patreon. Or if you want to buy a shirt or something, you can find merchandise at spreadshop.com or support the channel through one-time donations or super chats. Feel free to subscribe, follow, like or dislike, leave a raving or scathing review, and don't forget to tell a friend about me. I think I have to stop trying to introduce stories to you. It's always kind of the same. Today is a case of a horrible, awful murder and the stupid person that did it. So, big surprise, today is a true crime story for you. This one is Canadian, and let's have a listen to me ramble on about it for you.
Believe me, if I started murdering people, there'd be none of you left.
We are all evil in some form or another.
Melissa Ann Russell was born on May 16, 1935 in Burnt Church, New Brunswick. Burnt Church is actually one of the first reserve lands set aside by New Brunswick for the Mi'kmaq people of New Brunswick and is the Burnt Church First Nation Reserve. However, after the Seven Years' War, a few Acadians and Scottish people moved back to the area, and now the village or the community is split into the reserve lands and the non-native community. Melissa was born on the non-native community side of Burnt Church. And other than that, I really don't know much about her childhood. But growing up in that remote of an area and with First Nation reserves notorious for having a lack of funding and resources, she likely grew up in poverty. But she had big city and prosperous dreams of a lifestyle that was more befitting to what she thought she deserved. In 1953, she moved to the province of Ontario and started taking evening classes through correspondence, which I guess for you younger folks, that would be much like taking it over the internet, only they actually mailed you your assignments and then you would do them and then you would mail them back to them to be marked. It was a thing, and it's actually how I got my accounting education. Anyways, Ontario is a big province, and I'm not sure what area she moved to, but there she met Russell Shepherd in 1955, and the couple married, and they had two children together. I know that one of them is a daughter, but I don't know anything else about her kids' names and ages or anything like that. The family was going along well and moved to Prince Edward Island on Canada's east coast. And then, as legend has it, and I say legend because I wasn't actually able to confirm this part 100% as actual fact, but it seems pretty legit. Russell was diagnosed in 1971 when they were both in their mid-30s with Hodgkin's lymphoma. Hodgkin lymphoma is a blood cancer, but it attacks the lymphatic system, hence the name. It does have a good survival rate, about 90%, but is still not a walk in the park. I mean, it is still cancer after all. And the survival rate depends on a number of factors like your age, gender, and the stage at which it's caught at, and also if there are any tumors associated with it. And as the legend goes, this diagnosis resulted in the couple having some financial issues, which, being in Canada, I wouldn't think would have as much to do with the costs of hospitalization or medications and treatment, but more to do with the fact that Russell was unable to work during that time, draining the family's finances, which put Melissa in a difficult position. So she decided to dip her toes into some fraudulent check writing and issuing a few fake identities to cash some checks. And it must have been something that got her 30-something mom of two kids' juices flowing, because by 1980, Russell was now up and mobile and in remission, she continued to do it over and over again. And by 1980, when she was caught, she was charged with about 30 charges in all of fraud and forgery. and was sentenced to 5 years in prison. Her children, I'm sure, were super proud of her. Russell stayed on as her loving, supportive, and devoted husband. I'm not sure if he knew what she had been doing all that time, but he believed in the for better or for worse thing, I guess. And in December of 1985, she was released from prison and moved back to Prince Edward Island with Russell. Her kids were grown by then and had left the coop. Having turned 50 that year, I guess the support of a husband for 30 years wasn't enough for her, and her eyes started to wander. And in 1988, wandered on to 44-year-old widowed factory worker Gordon Stewart, who was selling his property in Prince Edward Island to move to Ontario, father to two near adult children and recently widowed from his wife of many, many years, who had recently died of cancer. And although she was still married at the time, she began an affair with Gordon and moved to Ontario with him. And I believe it was near the Kingston area. She divorced Russell and then married Gordon, and the couple then moved to Dartmouth, which is in Nova Scotia. And then on April 22nd, 1991, in the late evening, Melissa walked into the local police station to let them know that Gordon had either R-worded her or tried to R-word her. Her story has changed a little bit over the years. And oh, yeah, she ran over him with her Chevy Cavalier to get away from him, and he's probably dead. You should probably go check on that, or at least get him out of the road. Well, she probably didn't say those exact words. I'm paraphrasing a bit, but she wasn't exactly remorseful or even really shook up as one would expect for either having just accidentally run over someone or being someone that was just assaulted in a sexual manner. And when the police went out to this side road in Goffs near the Halifax airport to pick up his body and look into the situation, they discovered that not only had she backed over him in her escape attempt, but then ran back over him again when she went forwards over his body like a speed bump. And when they ran a toxicology on him, he had a fatal, as in definitely going to kill you, levels of Valium, Restorol, and rubbing alcohol in his system. Now, Gordon was known to be kind of a heavy drinker, but this was more than excessive drinking. This was, well, fatal. So how did this guy that had to be pretty much comatose at least drive them out there, let alone set on trying to assault her? And in her story, she said that he had been actually abusing her physically and then had drove her out there against her will and then tried to assault her, but was unsuccessful in that. In fact, years later, her story on this gets a little bit muddled. At one point, he definitely R-worded her. Then he tried. He was going to do it. Whatever. But then he got out of the car to pee and was behind the car, which she didn't know he was there. And then she took off, seeing it as her opportunity to escape, and then accidentally put the car into reverse, ran him over accidentally, and then had to go forward, like she couldn't back up any further in order to leave. Now, to be a wee bit fair to Melissa's telling of the story, just before Christmas, Gordon had been admitted to the hospital disoriented with a high dose of Valium in his system. And in March, Melissa had gotten a restraining order against him for an assault that he had pled guilty to. But the couple had reconciled by April 1991 when this event had happened. In her story, Gordon had forced her at knife point to drive around that whole day before he assaulted her in the woods off of this dirt road, which would have been difficult in his condition. There was also no physical evidence of any assault, either on her body. There was no dirt on her clothes. They had tried to use a tracking dog as well to come up with some kind of indication that the two of them had even been in the woods together, and they couldn't do that. And so the police and the prosecutor's office, therefore, had a little bit of a different theory on how things had gone down that night. This theory was a little bit bolstered by them when they discovered this letter that Gordon had written not long before his death, where he basically laid out Melissa, that Melissa had cheated on him numerous times in their short marriage and had lied about practically everything and had been draining his bank accounts of his pension that he had gotten from being in the Department of National Defense. They felt that she had been the one that had driven Gordon out to the rural road, that she had drugged him with this cocktail of Valium and rubbing alcohol, and that when they arrived at this dirt road, he would have either been unconscious or probably already dead when she then ran over him twice to make sure that he was dead, and then waited 3 hours before reporting it to the police. Money, specifically Gordon's pension benefits, not this assault, had been the motive for what was at best second-degree murder and first-degree at the worst. Well, she wound up going on trial for second-degree murder, and I have no idea what kind of defense attorney she managed to get, but he must have done a pretty amazing job of painting this poor Gordon Stewart as an abusive monster, because she was only convicted of manslaughter in 1992, and to top it off, her sentence was 6 years, but it only worked out to about 2 years because of good behavior. And what kind of good behavior could get a person convicted of manslaughter out of the notoriously rough women's prison in Kingston after serving less than half of their sentence? Well, apparently, if you form a support group for victims of DV and become a spokesperson for DV victims, that tends to work, which annoys me to the nth degree to make false accusations against someone. And then to piss me off even more about this, after she got out, well, what did she do? She traveled around the country giving speeches to women about DV and battered women's syndrome and the pitfalls and benefits of killing in self-defense, even receiving at one point a government grant to help her out in her community outreach program. There was a brave journalist named Barb McKenna, who is from The Guardian, that did write an article about her, kind of hinting that her claims against Gordon were probably unwarranted. She tried to sue her to shut her up. Now, I'm not sure if she got any money out of that, but it certainly did shut Barb up from writing any further articles about her. In 1994, the National Film Board did a documentary on women who kill, and Melissa got a featured spot in the documentary. In 1996, she set up a toll-free number for women in jail to receive counseling called Project Another Chance. When her parole period was up in April of 2000, she decided that Florida was the place to be for a single and ready-to-mingle 65-year-old woman. She had supposedly found God while she was in prison and was reading this religious retreat newsletter. And there she spotted a picture of the lovely Robert Frederick, who had lost his wife of 53 years just the year before. Also, he was a retired engineer with a good pension and lots of savings. Melissa wrote to him that she had seen him speak at a prayer meeting and the Holy Spirit had told her that they were to be together. And something about her chat with the Holy Spirit must have moved Robert, because he invited her to visit him. And 3 days after she came, they were engaged. And they traveled back to Dartmouth together to tie the knot at this interfaith chapel, before returning to Florida to live together. And almost immediately after they got married, Robert's health starts to take a little bit of a turn. Now, granted, Robert was already elderly when they met, but he was actually in really good shape and had been in great health for someone of his age, which would have been in about his 70s. But he was suddenly in and out of the hospital for these dizzy spells and falling. And his family, particularly his son Dennis and his wife, noticed that they would talk to him on the phone, and his speech would be kind of slurred, and he just wouldn't sound very good. But when they saw him in person, he looked and acted quite fine. So Dennis became a little bit suspicious, and he hadn't really liked the idea of his dad marrying somebody so soon after just meeting her. He understood that after losing his wife of 50 years that he was lonely and he didn't really feel like he had a lot of time left, but something about Melissa had turned Dennis and his wife kind of off. And after a few trips to the hospital where he would quickly recover and then be sent home again where it would kind of happen again to him, and noticing that they were spending quite a bit of money that the normally frugal Robert wouldn't have spent, they had been tipped off to this by Robert's financial advisor, who told Dennis that Robert's savings were basically being drained. So Dennis called the elder abuse hotline to look into it. And in response, Melissa left Dennis a rather nasty voice message.
Hello, Bob. This is Melissa Friedrich calling. I have something to share with you this morning. Your father and I are going to see a lawyer who's made an appointment. And your father is going to change his will. He's going to leave all the money to me except for the portion that he had set aside for you and your two brothers. And that portion now is going to go to the Christian retreat. And you guys are getting nothing. A big, fat zero. So try that on for size and have a nice day.
That Robert had changed his will, leaving everything to her and nothing to them, and how do you like them apples? Robert Friedrich died of apparent cardiac arrest on December 16th, 2002. But Melissa handled the death of her husband like a trooper. She ordered his body cremated, no autopsy, emptied his bank account of $400,000, and didn't bother to tell the IRS of his death and continued to collect his Social Security benefits for 2 more years, until she decided to move back to Canada and settled back in Prince Edward Island again. Robert's two sons, Dennis and Bob, filed a lawsuit against Melissa and did manage to get their father's life insurance money back. Melissa was able to keep, though, $15,000 had been all that was now left of Robert's estate. In September of 2003, the Manatee County Sheriff's Office in Florida started an investigation into Melissa. Not for killing her third husband, but for doctor shopping and prescription fraud. During March 1st, 2001 and December 1st of 2002, she had a number of prescriptions for lorazepam, which is much like Valium, from more than one doctor. But they determined that they didn't have enough evidence against her to formally file any charges. Then, in January 2004, the Human Resources Development Canada, who is the agency that directs and distributes old age security, they started their own investigation into Melissa for collecting benefits fraudulently, about $30,000 worth. They, too, had to drop their investigation because there just wasn't enough evidence. But this whole investigation thing, including Dennis and Bob sniffing around with suspicion that Melissa had poisoned their father in order to bilk him out of all his money, was really no bother to Melissa, who joined AmericanSinglesDating.com and by November 2004 had decided on 73-year-old divorced and lonely Alex Strategos, who was a diabetic living in none other than the state of Florida, in Pinellas Park. And on November 5th, 2004, Melissa made the long drive from Prince Edward Island to Florida to have dinner with Alex. And then they went back to his place to do whatever they do. And Alex got up in the night to have his nightly pee, as you do, only to get dizzy and pass out. And he was taken to the hospital, and it was determined that probably the fun of the evening had just kind of gotten the best of him. Melissa and him decided to stay together to live as a married couple because, of course, she needed to take care of the poor guy. Now, Alex's son was immediately suspicious of Melissa. Something about her didn't feel right. Alex didn't have any money like Robert did. He only had a meager $18,000 in savings. But Melissa had quickly drained that. And Alex's health had also taken a sudden turn for the worse. In fact, he was hospitalized for these fainting and falling spells 8 times over the next 2 months. Doctors were baffled by this, and Melissa decided that she was getting a little too old to be taking care of her common-law husband of 2 months, and so she thought that he should be put into a nursing home. And at that time, she also had him sign over power of attorney to herself. Alex's son was extra not impressed and felt helpless to do anything for his father, who had just 3 months before, although having diabetes, was jovial and happy and now seemed kind of half out of it most of the time, and also depressed about his failing health. Well, Alex's son one night reviewed Alex's medical paperwork and his financial records that had been provided by the nursing home and discovered that during his hospital visits, lorazepam had been found in his system each time. Now, this was a drug that he knew his father had never been prescribed. He also noticed that Alex's bank account had a balance now of only like $2.36 in it. So he called the police, and Melissa was brought in for questioning and must have done a pretty good job of answering their questions, because even after a search had been done at Alex's condo and they had found bags of pills and emails exchanged with several different men lining up dates, she was arrested for grand theft and forgery, but they still couldn't get the evidence that she had been the one to give Alex the lorazepam that was causing his falls and his dizziness. Alex, when looking back on this, figured she had been giving it to him through his nightly ice cream. She would bring him a little tiny bowl of ice cream each night. Not enough ice cream to set off his diabetes, but containing enough sedative to make him dizzy and a fall risk. Melissa pled guilty and was sentenced in Florida to 5 years. Now, Alex fortunately survived and lived out his remaining days at a nursing home in Florida, but in better health than during his short-lived relationship with Melissa. A coincidence? I highly doubt it. Now, after serving a whopping 4 years, on April 4th, 2009, Melissa was once again released from incarceration in Florida and then immediately deported back to Canada, where she once again settled in New Brunswick at the Quinway apartment complex for seniors. And that is where, in September of 2012, she met 75-year-old Fred Weeks. Melissa at the time was 77, and Fred had lost his wife about a year and a half before, to whom he had been married for over 50 years, and at the time was filling his days with games of crib at the senior center. And as per her pattern, they quickly married, much to the dismay and concern of his good friend George, who had seen Melissa, then known as Millie, on the TV in this documentary about her little pattern of dead and sick husbands. Grudgingly, when Fred said that he would be fine and that there was nothing to worry about, George performed their marriage ceremony for them on the 25th of September. And 2 days later, they decided to honeymoon in Cape Breton. Only they showed up at the Bed and Breakfast Chambers Guest House in North Sydney, Nova Scotia, after this ferry ride that Melissa had said had kept them both up all night sick. The owner of the bed and breakfast noted that, yes, in fact, Fred arrived looking terrible and really quite ill, but Melissa looked chipper as a chipmunk. They spent the day in their room as Fred was sick, and when the owner came up to check on them, she thought that she had heard someone fall, and it had been Fred. And so she insisted on calling an ambulance. Well, Melissa, well, she wanted to at least finish her breakfast first. He was then taken by ambulance to the hospital, where Fred's son was told that his father was suffering from dementia, because he kept saying he had no children. Well, it was the son that had called, and he also had a daughter as well. Now, before this trip to the hospital, the worst Fred had was maybe a little bit of high cholesterol. So the son contacted the police to look into the whole matter of this misdiagnosis. apparently, Melissa had also told neighbors at the seniors' apartments that Fred didn't have any children and that he had dementia and, as well, COPD, and that he had had a number of heart attacks. Now, none of this was true. So Fred was actually in really good health, both physically and mentally. And by this time, the police and most of the eastern side of the country was well aware of Melissa's pattern with men. So the police were more than happy to investigate the matter. Fred, who thankfully recovered and was released from the hospital, his records showed that he had a high dose of Valium in his system and that there were 144 tablets of lorazepam in unlabeled bottles and prescriptions for the drugs from 5 different doctors. Also, a suspicious-looking tub of ice cream. So after getting out of the hospital, Fred really didn't remember much between the wedding and waking up in the hospital and being told that his wife had tried to kill him. He's not even sure if they took a ferry at all out to that bed and breakfast. But there was found to be a mistake on the marriage license, which nullified their marriage. So they were actually never in fact legally married, meaning she wouldn't be entitled to any benefits had she managed to kill him. At the age of 78, Melissa Ann Russell Stewart Frederick Weeks pled guilty to administering a noxious thing and failing to provide the necessaries of life.
In Nova Scotia, a judge urged the public to be cautious after a woman dubbed the Black Widow was handed her sentence today. The 78-year-old received 3.5 years for spiking her new husband's coffee on their honeymoon last fall. As Ross Lord reports, some are wondering why the sentence was so lenient, given the severity of the crime and her past.
With a criminal record spanning more than 4 decades, Melissa Shepherd is going back to prison, just not for as long as some people would like. Her official sentence for poisoning her newlywed is 3.5 years, but with credit for time already served in custody, she could be out on parole in less than 1 year because the Crown dropped the main charge.
The attempted murder charge just was not viable.
Deciding there was no proof she tried to kill 75-year-old Fred Weeks, the Crown accepted a guilty plea to 2 lesser charges.
She managed to once again avoid attempted murder charges. Maximum sentence is 2 years for administering a noxious thing and 18 months for failing to provide the necessaries of life. She was, however, denied bond while she was waiting for sentencing, which turned out to be 3.5 years. Justice Philip Kennedy saying, "People who have contact with this lady should be very careful." She was officially released on March 18th in 2016 in Nova Scotia under some strict conditions to behave herself. As she moved to the city of Halifax, she was considered a high risk to reoffend. She was 81 years old.
Oh, Eddie.
She's back. The so-called Internet Black Widow, named for her string of lovers who became mysteriously ill, some of them dying, will be released this week. Shepherd has a long line of convictions for fraud, theft, and manslaughter in the death of another husband. Now, in her early 80s, the concern is Shepherd still has that certain je ne sais quoi some men just can't seem to resist. What's more, the Crown fears she may revisit some of her old romances.
We believe that she poses a risk going forward to the particular group of elderly males that she has preyed on in the past.
Less than a month later, she was spotted at the Halifax Central Library by a community response officer accessing the internet and having a device capable of accessing the internet, which was likely a bunch of legal mumbo jumbo for having a cell phone. And this was, of course, a breach of her conditions. She was charged, entered a not guilty plea on this breach, but the charges were dropped in December of 2016 for whatever reason. I'm pretty sure she wasn't looking up a recipe for chocolate cookies. As recently as 2021, which was the last reporting I could find, she is still reported to be alive. If she is alive today, she would be 90, probably still dangerous. And that was the murder of Gordon Stewart and probably Robert Frederick and the could have been murders of Alex and Fred. Crazy that she was able to just kind of go about her business for so many years, ruining so many men's lives, and really no one really tried to stop her. But with that, I'm going to be back again next week with another case. And as always, thank you so much for listening.
Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated.
forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. Just a reminder that you can skip the ads by signing up on Patreon to A Million Other Choices. If you or someone you love has been a victim of violent crime, please use your online directory to access victim services available in all provinces, territories, and states. You can find specialized services for children, Aboriginal people, and survivors of domestic violence. Some provinces have injury compensation or financial assistance programs. If you are in immediate danger, call 911, or if you are thinking of suicide, please call or text 988.